He was best known as an architect of America's so-called War on Terror, and his influence on U.S. foreign policy stretched back to the 1970s.
Cheney becomes one of the apostles of increasing executive power.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, the legacy of Dick Cheney. Also on the show, despite its own backsliding on democracy, Turkey has a growing role in European defense.
Whether many people like it or not is going to have to be part of European security.
Plus, a phone is a lifeline, but it can also be a liability.
If someone has access to that, they know probably more about you than your closest friends and family members.
That is certainly the case for Uyghurs fleeing China.
Those stories and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it today. The news broke this morning. Former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney died on Monday at the age of 84.
He served two terms alongside George W. Bush, who said in a statement that Cheney's death was a loss to the nation. Bush went on to call Cheney one of the finest public servants of his generation.
Before he was vice president, Cheney filled senior positions in previous administrations, White House chief of staff under Gerald Ford in the 1970s, and secretary of defense under George H.W. Bush in the late 1980s and early 90s.
For decades, he exerted powerful influence over matters of foreign policy and national security. That was especially true after the September 11th attacks in 2001. Cheney's approach was polarizing at the time, and as The World's Matthew Bell explains, his legacy today is no less contentious.
Dick Cheney was born in Lincoln, Nebraska, and grew up in Casper, Wyoming. He never served in the military. He went to Yale, but he got kicked out twice. After dropping out of grad school in Wisconsin, Cheney made his way to Washington as a young man. He got hired by a congressman named Donald Rumsfeld to work in President Richard Nixon's Office of Economic Opportunity. In 1974, Gerald Ford picked Rumsfeld to be White House Chief of Staff. Cheney went along as his top aide. He was just 33 years old at the time.
What I think is distinctive by the mid-1970s is Cheney becomes one of the apostles of increasing executive power.
Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School.
He saw Watergate as an example of congressional overreach and came out of the Nixon and Ford years believing that we needed to try and strengthen the presidency as much as possible.
We'll get back to executive power in a bit, but first, on foreign affairs, the real high point for Dick Cheney was in 1990. He was Secretary of Defense under George Bush Sr. The Iraqi strongman, Saddam Hussein, had invaded his neighbor, Kuwait, and Bush responded by putting together a broad multilateral force to drive the Iraqi military out. Hussein Ibish is with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington.
Under the color of the United Nations Charter, which forbids the acquisition of territory by war, and with the approval of the Security Council, and with this very large international and Arab coalition behind it, the U.S. led the rapid and successful liberation of Kuwait and stopped at the border of Iraq.
Here's part of an interview that Defense Secretary Cheney gave to the American Enterprise Institute in early 1991 as the first Gulf War was coming to an end.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? It's a quagmire.
Stephen Walt from Harvard says it's quite prophetic to hear Cheney talking about demonstrating restraint at a moment of victory, telling his critics that they're wrong about sending the U.S. military into Baghdad to topple Saddam Hussein.
12 years later, he acts in exactly the opposite way. He ignores all of the things that he had said back then when he was defending the first Bush administration, and we all know what the results are.
Faisal Istrabadi spent much of his childhood in Baghdad. He and his family moved to the United States in 1970 after Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party seized power in a coup. After the U.S. invasion of 2003, Istrabadi became Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations. He says he supported the invasion for one simple reason.
Whether I was right or wrong is neither here nor there. Prospectively, I supported the war because I couldn't imagine Saddam Hussein leaving office any other way than by a foreign intervention by a power like the United States.
Istrabadi is currently the director of the Center for the Study of the Middle East at Indiana University. He says Cheney deserves credit for driving the policy decisions that led to the removal of Saddam Hussein.
One of the greatest despots to rule in the last quarter of the 20th century of any country in the world.
But Cheney's legacy also includes what came after the fall of the government in Baghdad. Istrabadi says the vice president and other hawkish U.S. officials who'd been pushing for the war failed to plan for the aftermath of the invasion, in part because they were ideologically blind to facts on the ground.
When all of us who were in Iraq at the time could see in late 2003 that the insurgency was really beginning to gain speed. And you could tell it was going the wrong direction. And, you know, Cheney gets up in national news and says the insurgency is in its last throes. It was just beginning.
Looking back at the U.S. occupation of Iraq, Faisal Istrabadi says things could not have been handled more incompetently. This is all part of the legacy of Dick Cheney. That legacy is also wrapped up in what Istrabadi describes as the strategic blunder of the so-called War on Terror, the 20-year U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, and the national security policies pushed by Dick Cheney during his time in the Bush White House. They're very much part of what's shaping U.S. foreign policy in 2025, says Spencer Ackerman. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and the author of Reign of Terror: How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump.
Cheney, more than any other figure to have ever achieved presidential or near presidential power, was committed to an idea that we now know as the unitary executive theory, which holds that all executive power is consolidated within the office of the presidency, even if the architects of some of those components of executive power, like the intelligence agencies, like the Justice Department, are supposed to be non-political and independent. Cheney did away with that.
Ackerman says the late vice president nudged the door open, and when President Trump took office in January, he eagerly walked through it. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
A new investigation has found that the U.S. oil giant Exxon funded a campaign to influence public opinion about climate change in Latin America. This was in the 1990s and early 2000s. That's according to the climate investigations site DSMOG, in collaboration with British newspaper The Guardian. DSMOG obtained documents that show Exxon paid tens of thousands of dollars to a network of think tanks that sowed skepticism about climate change. Jeff Dembicki worked on the investigation. He is DSMOG's global managing editor, and he explained what those documents revealed.
The documents that we obtained included funding proposals, personal letters, and copies of actual checks that Exxon wrote to a U.S.-based coalition called Atlas Network, which these days includes more than 500 free market think tanks and other partners across the world.
And what did you find about what Atlas Network or those think tanks used that money for?
Atlas Network, in the correspondence with Exxon, was explicit that it wanted countries across Latin America and the global south to become skeptical of the United Nations-led climate treaty process. And so it asked Exxon for funding that Atlas Network and its partners could use to spread climate change denial all across the region.
What do you know about what Exxon's motivations were in trying to influence policy back in the 90s and early 2000s?
I can't comment directly on what Exxon's motivations are, but I can say what is in the documents. And in one 1997 strategy plan that Atlas Network sent to Exxon, Atlas explained that funding from Exxon could lead to, quote, continued strong returns to Exxon's investors.
Which means?
Atlas Network seemed to be implying in that strategy plan that this ultimately would be good for Exxon's bottom line.
And take us back to the 1990s in Latin America. What was the policy environment around climate change and what was the public understanding about it at the time?
So in the late 1990s, the world was really waking up to the fact that global temperature rise was a huge and urgent issue. And so the world's nations had gathered in Kyoto, Japan in 1997 and negotiated the world's first legally binding climate treaty. And so there were a lot of developing nations across Latin America and the global south who really saw climate change as a major existential threat to their economies. And they were interested in figuring out some sort of global deal that could account for their unique development situation while also inducing the kind of global emissions cuts we would need to get a hold of the crisis.
And so what exactly were these think tanks funded by Exxon doing to try to sow skepticism of the UN climate diplomacy process?
So one thing that these think tanks in Latin America did was they took books and pamphlets by prominent U.S. climate change deniers, including people like Fred Singer, and they translated them into other languages. So they translated some of Singer's books into Spanish, for example, and then they disseminated those texts all over the developing world to try to export some of the climate denial tactics that Exxon and others had been using in the United States. Some of these Atlas Network partner organizations, they also created reports in the languages of their various countries, warning that any sort of UN climate treaty would be absolutely devastating for local economies. Mm-hmm. And prior to that effort, there was sort of a common wisdom that actually addressing climate change would be good for the economy.
I want to note here that we reached out to ExxonMobil. They did not respond with a comment about this in time for our conversation here. A spokesperson from the Atlas Network, Adam Weinberg, did respond by referring us to the Atlas Network's publicly available statement on your investigation, which said that, quote, these questions deal with memos and materials drafted by former employees from more than a quarter century ago, addressed to a corporation that was never an important donor to our organization, and which indeed has not been a donor at all for close to two decades. The payments that you found were not huge. How much could payments of $15,000 or $50,000 actually make a real impact in climate policy globally?
Well, there's two ways to look at that. One is that we have to adjust for inflation. So some of these amounts are bigger in today's dollars. But I would quote Atlas Network's own words to Exxon in a 1998 funding proposal where it wrote that, quote, even relatively small investments in developing nations can produce substantial results. Hmm.
So I know that climate denialism, skepticism, misinformation has morphed over the decades. Where does it stand now? What role do oil and gas companies play today in the UN climate process, for example? What role will they play at COP30 coming up next week?
These documents that we obtained, they cover a period in the late 90s and early 2000s. And since then, both Atlas Network and Exxon have said that they acknowledge the scientific reality of climate change. But I think what we are still seeing each year with these climate change negotiations is that oil companies and various other organizations that have been associated with them over the years are still making the case worldwide that we should keep drilling for more oil and gas, we should keep burning it, we should keep increasing our use of it. And all of that is completely incompatible with efforts to get global temperature rise under control.
Jeff Dembicki is the global managing editor at DSMOG, an outlet that investigates stories about climate change. His story about Exxon appeared this week in collaboration with The Guardian. A turning point in Middle East history 30 years ago today. That story is just ahead. You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We are hearing today about former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney's large influence on foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. We want to look at another key player, Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, who served twice. That second term was cut short when he was assassinated 30 years ago today. Rabin is remembered for turning Israel away from war and toward diplomacy. When the Oslo Peace Accords were signed in 1993, it was the first time Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization formally recognized each other. At the White House ceremony, Rabin predicted what would happen if the agreement failed.
If all the partners to the peacemaking do not unite against the evil angels of death by terrorism, all that will remain of this ceremony are color snapshots, empty mementos. Rivers of hatred will overflow again and swamp the Middle East.
Those remarks now ring eerily prescient. Rabin was killed by a far-right Israeli extremist at a peace rally in Tel Aviv on this day in 1995. Robert Malley joined us to reflect on Rabin's legacy, but also what has and has not transpired in his absence. Malley is a longtime Middle East diplomat and co-author of a new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, about the pursuit of peace in the region. I asked him if that means the region's past problems are still with us.
Unfortunately, yes. And listening to what former Prime Minister Rabin said, and I had not heard that for a while, eerily prescient, as you said. We chose the title of the book because everything we're seeing today has been seen tragically in the past.
Yitzhak Rabin did not explicitly use a term two-state solution, nor did he publicly endorse a fully sovereign Palestinian state. But was he attempting, with the Oslo Accords, to lay the groundwork for two states?
I mean, we'll never really know. The last speech he gave at the Knesset took a pretty hard line, but maybe he did that for domestic reasons. Maybe he did that out of conviction. Oslo, you could look at it as a momentous achievement, which it was, but it also was fatally flawed in the sense that it didn't describe the outcome. The Israelis could have read it and said, we never committed to a Palestinian state. We never committed to ending the settlement enterprise in the West Bank. I think Palestinians looked at it and thought this was their pathway to self-determination and to statehood. And that ambiguity never got resolved. In fact, it only deepened with time.
I mean, indeed, Oslo has long been seen as a landmark accomplishment. So what did it accomplish and where did it fall short?
And what it accomplished is the first understanding agreement between Israelis and Palestinians, mutual recognition. Now, even the mutual recognition is a bit lopsided. The Palestinians recognize the State of Israel. The Israelis recognized the Palestine Liberation Organization as a representative of the Palestinian people. There was no state to recognize, but even in that discrepancy, one sees the seeds of future misunderstanding. But just the fact that the PLO and Israel could sit together, reach this understanding, agree that on a path to the future, that's something that had never happened before. And in that sense, it really was a breakthrough. The flaws, and they became more apparent with time, was number one, that there was no agreement on what the destination was. And when you don't know what the end result should be, then both sides did everything they could to maximize their position. And then at its core, and this is what Hussein Agha and I write in our book, there really was a misunderstanding, if you will, or two sides not really speaking on the same level. I think the Israelis felt that Oslo for them was a recipe to grant some degree of autonomy to the Palestinians in exchange for which they thought they were going to get full security. They thought that in exchange for their concession, and they thought it was a major concession to allow the Palestinians to govern themselves to some degree, the Palestinians would ensure that they would be safe. For the Palestinians, it was a very different bargain. They thought that they were making the big concession by agreeing to a Palestinian state on the borders of 1967, giving up the historic claim to all of the land between the river and the sea of mandatory Palestine. And so they thought that was their concession. And in exchange for that, they were going to get a real sovereign Palestinian state. But that's like two sides talking past each other, the Palestinians saying, we made our concession, now we need to get some measure of justice. And the Israelis saying, we made the concession, why should we even have given you anything since we won the war and you should give us security?
It sounds like a bunch of assumptions on both sides. Was there anything resembling an end goal to Oslo?
Well, the end goal was there was going to be some final status between Israelis and Palestinians, but without any clarity about the borders, whether there would be a state, what would be the status of Jerusalem, what would happen to the settlements, what would happen to the Palestinian refugees. Now, one could say this was just the beginning. But when you have a beginning that is so fraught with ambiguity and with misunderstanding and with two parties that are looking at it from very different angles, it's very hard to get to the end goal and very easy to torpedo it, which was one of the consequences of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, which is whatever hope there had been, and it was a tenuous one, but it disappeared with the bullet that took his life.
So fast forward to recent years. Is there a direct line between the breakdown of the Oslo Accords and October 7th, 2023?
I think it's hard to argue otherwise, right? I mean, I think there's a straight line between the peace process even before the breakdown of Oslo and where we are today. It's not as if the massacres that occurred on October 7th or the slaughter that Israel perpetrated against Gazans afterwards came out of nowhere. So I think that's one of the lessons that needs to be learned. What went wrong? Because what went wrong led precisely to where we are today. Mm.
This week, we learned that the U.S. has sent to the U.N. Security Council a draft resolution for the establishment of an international force in Gaza, and that was described in the 20-point peace plan. It would give the U.S. and other participating countries a broad mandate to govern Gaza. What do you make of this idea?
You know, on the one hand, it's a terrible plan in terms of what it says about the Palestinians, that they're going to be micromanaged, that they have to sort of once again prove their worthiness to govern themselves. They're the ones who have to de-radicalize. There's no mention of the need for the Israelis to de-radicalize or de-Messianize, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it. It's as if the Palestinians have to be punished for everything they did, and the Israelis don't have to, there's no accountability for what they perpetrated. And the notion that you're going to have this board of peace led by President Trump that's going to control everything that happens in Gaza, you know, it doesn't necessarily sit that well. That being said, compared to where things were, compared to the horror that Gaza has lived for the last 2 years, even if we've gone from an utter hell to a mere nightmare, I would pick the nightmare over hell.
You know, we can understand why an international force is needed now, but in your wildest imagination, when you were sitting at Camp David with President Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, and Oslo was then signed, was that on your bingo card?
No, it was not. Although there's always been this idea that you need some kind of international presence because of the lack of trust between Israelis and Palestinians. So that idea has been floated. But the notion of sort of a mandate, and you know, it is pretty ironic. We call the book Tomorrow's Yesterday before this happened, but the notion of a mandate, a Western mandate, in this case U.S., but also perhaps with a Brit, Tony Blair, in charge, if anything is reminiscent of the past, that is, in addition, without any consultation with the local population, that too is quite reminiscent of the past. So maybe we should have thought of it, maybe we should have expected it to happen, but I can't say that 30 years ago, as I sat on the White House lawn watching Yitzhak Rabin, President Clinton, and Yasser Arafat, that I thought that 30 years later, this is what we'd be witnessing.
Longtime diplomat Robert Malley is the co-author of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Let's catch you up on some other headlines we're following this Tuesday.
Starting in the Philippines, where a typhoon has killed at least 26 people. The heavy rains yesterday brought flooding that left people trapped in on their roofs and standing on top of submerged cars. Another six people died in a helicopter that crashed while trying to deliver humanitarian aid to places that were battered by the storm.
Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says he will personally call President Trump if tariff negotiations with the U.S. do not make progress, and soon. I have his number, he has mine, Lula told reporters. I have no trouble in calling him. Brazil is getting ready to host the U.N.'s climate summit starting next week. Lula says if no talks have been scheduled by the time the summit ends, he'll be picking up the phone.
Finally, the New York City mayoral election today features the meteoric rise of Democratic candidate Zoran Mamdani. Leaders of the European left have come to New York to learn what they can ahead of their own elections next year. A left-leaning French party sent one of its co-chairs to New York, and one party in Germany sent four officials to meet with Mamdani's chief of strategy.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
Yeah. China's oppression of Uyghurs inside China has been well documented, but even members of the ethnic group who flee the country have to contend with Chinese surveillance abroad. A digital rights watchdog in Canada, Citizen Lab, has been tracking this. One of the researchers there, Rebecca Brown, came on the Click Here podcast to talk about how China is pulling it off. This story is part of a series from Click Here about the digital surveillance of Uyghurs. Host Dina Temple-Raston picks up the thread.
These days, about 12 million Uyghurs live in Xinjiang, a region in China's far northwest. But they've lived in Central Asia for thousands of years. They've outlasted emperors, endured dynasties like the Shang, the Tang, and the Ming. But Rebecca Brown says they've never quite bowed to Beijing.
They were very far away from Beijing, kind of very remote. They always had their own identity and their own culture, and they did not want to be part of the centralized system.
They're Muslims. They speak their own language. All of which is to say, Uyghurs are outliers. And for much of the last century, that was tolerated. Until 2013.
Delegates cast their ballots for China's next president. Now officially one of the most powerful men in the world, Xi Jinping.
When Chinese leader Xi Jinping took power, he launched what he called a people's war on what they deemed as separatism. Minorities like the Uyghurs found themselves in the crosshairs.
China really views any pushback to the narrative of the Chinese Communist Party as a threat.
Beijing flooded Xinjiang with police. They banned Ramadan celebrations. They arrested more than a million people and put them in camps, calling it re-education. But this wasn't just old-school authoritarianism. This time, they're also wielding modern tools for oppression, things like smartphones and spyware.
In modern times, your phone is with you almost all the time. It is like your digital fingerprints, everything you do, everywhere you go. If someone has access to that, they know probably more about you than your closest friends and family members.
Among other things, China rolled out a special app and made it mandatory to download.
They said it was for safety, but would allow the authorities access to information on your phone about what you're doing and your location and where you are. It was kind of a campaign saying you need to install this, this needs to be on your phone, and then, you know, checkpoints and random checks to make sure that it was installed.
And then they went further. QR codes outside homes, GPS trackers in cars, they began surveilling Wi-Fi. The kind of surveillance you can do on a territory that you control. But then, the Chinese government spread their surveillance web beyond their own borders, and they started targeting Uyghurs abroad.
The next extension of surveillance is not just people within the control, but people who've left or maybe who have family. They want to find out who they're talking to. How is information getting in and out?
Because it wasn't just about controlling how people live their lives.
They wanted it to be seen as, oh no, we're all one nation and we're bettering the population and this is voluntary and everyone's happy here. And so whenever information would get out that countered that narrative, they wanted to know how it was getting out and to whom.
Even Uyghurs who've managed to flee the country aren't safe. More than 500,000 Uyghurs live outside China today. Some joined advocacy groups like the World Uyghur Congress. But exile doesn't necessarily mean escape. Even oceans away, Beijing's reach can be uncanny.
There were reports of different campaigns that would actually find flaws in operating systems of both iPhones and Androids in order to remotely install spyware on phones.
And the entry point? Not state-run news, not political pamphlets, cultural lifelines turned into weapons.
It was targeting websites that Uyghurs would traditionally visit.
Websites hosting Qurans, Uyghur dictionaries, poetry archives, harmless on the surface until you clicked.
An app that you would install on your phone because, you know, it's of interest and it would be beneficial and it's helpful, especially if you're living overseas, if you're, you know, one of these communities living in exile and you're trying to stay connected to your culture.
But you'd be doing the opposite. You'd be inviting surveillance into your life. What they didn't know is that they were letting the Chinese government just waltz into their pockets as well. And that's the strategy. undermine the tools meant to preserve Uyghur identity.
There's a lot that can be discovered about you by having that type of access, more than just being able to see via surveillance cameras where people are, or just knowing which house you live in. There's this level of information about a person's life by having access to their information on a computer or on a phone.
This kind of attack serves a dual purpose.
This type of attack is especially harmful because not only is it feeding into the surveillance engine, but it is supporting kind of that goal of erasure. Because now, once this comes to light, people can be very afraid of these tools that can be used to help maintain their cultural identity and maintain their language, because they don't know, is this being weaponized or is this going to harm me, or can I trust this?
This isn't just conjecture. A few months ago, in March of this year, a senior member of the World Uyghur Congress received an email. The message claimed to be from an ally, someone offering help, a fellow activist who said a developer had created a new tool, something meant to help Uyghurs in exile write and preserve their language. The program was called Uyghur Edit Plus+, a word processor designed to help people type in Uyghur, with a built-in spell check.
And so this was meant to be perfect. It's tailor-made. It can make sure you've spelled things correctly and that you can write, you know, exactly as they want to when you're not trying.
The person reaching out said they needed someone to test it.
And this email said, hey, we have this piece of software that was created by an anonymous developer who wants to help the Uyghur community. It's a language tool, but we don't know how to test it. Can you please, you know, test it and tell us, is this helpful so we can share and help the community?
Attached was a link to a Google Drive folder, and inside, a free download. But then, something strange happened.
They got these Google notifications saying, you've been targeted by a government-backed attack.
You've been targeted by a government-backed attacker. Imagine reading that line after clicking a link, thinking you were helping your community. The activists didn't hesitate. They picked up the phone and called Citizen Lab.
We got multiple calls all at once saying, hey, something big is going on. What should we do? What does this mean? And when something like that happens, we jump into action.
At face value, the request appeared legit. Uyghur Edit Plus+ is a real program used and trusted by Uyghur speakers around the world. But when they looked closer, they realized the email was suspicious. The sender claimed to be from a group that regularly worked with the World Uyghur Congress. But when they looked closer,
it was sent from not the official email. It was sent from another Gmail address that was trying to impersonate someone.
The file was sent to one of Rebecca's colleagues, someone who specialized in the kind of code Uyghur Edit Plus+ was written in. And he started looking for more clues.
He kind of knew instantly what to look for. And I think he was able to figure it out in a matter of minutes. Like, oh, okay, I know what this is. I know what we need to look for.
What they found was a Trojan horse. The download appeared to be safe on the surface, but once opened, it triggered a sequence of malware installations. The first wave included reconnaissance.
To confirm that you're on the right computer, look for the username and the geography and confirm that everything is right.
Once the malware confirmed it was inside the intended target's device, a second wave of attacks began.
A more capable type of malware that would be able to do things like monitor keystrokes and steal files and do a lot of that real-time monitoring of what was going on the laptop as well.
Had the activist gone all the way through with the installation, the hackers would have essentially owned their computer.
If they had run it on the computer, if they had taken this email at its word that, oh, we're trying to help the community, it would have ended up giving access to their computer to the Chinese government.
It would have handed the Chinese government a live feed of everything they typed. They reached out to Rydak Kenji, the developer of Uyghur Edit Plus+, to let him know his program was being hijacked. And he said he was dumbstruck by the breach.
When I first heard this news, I was very shocked, because I thought I had accidentally put a virus myself into this program. But after hearing the explanation from the staff at the Citizen Lab, I heard that this Uyghur application I made was free of any problems.
This is Rydat. And the thing was, he hadn't really been hacked exactly. Instead, his work had just been exploited.
When I released Uyghur Edit +++, I also released its source code. Therefore, it was easy to damage the software with this malware. It was filled with malicious software, including malware that stole information from Uyghur organizations and Uyghur activists. I curse the ones responsible for that.
What Rebecca and her colleagues at the Citizen Lab uncovered wasn't technically sophisticated. It was blunt, almost sloppy. But that didn't matter, because the power of the attack wasn't in its code. It was in the sophistication of their approach. The attackers had taken their time. They'd built fake websites. They'd registered fake domains and faked an entire identity, all to make a malicious file look like a gift.
Almost a year ago, they had started setting up infrastructure also to try and impersonate this developer. They created domains in his name. There was just a lot of thought and intentionality behind this attack that you don't always see.
You go to all this trouble because if the code doesn't catch you, the fear just might. If even a legitimate cultural tool like Uyghur Edit +++ can be weaponized, then it would make people wonder, what's safe?
To erase the Uyghur identity and to steal information about the Uyghurs. No one else does it except the spies of the Chinese Communist Party. This is simply a common tool.
So Rydat went back online and posted a message. If you want to access Uyghur Edit +++, download it straight from GitHub. No shortcuts, no cloud folders, no mystery links.
I uploaded Uyghur Edit on GitHub. Its source code is open for everyone to benefit from and view. There is no hidden malware in what I've shared.
He's doing what he can to try to restore people's trust, to encourage them to keep using tools that keep Uyghurs around the world still connected to their culture, their language, and to each other. But the threat isn't going away.
People want to think that these digital assets, that if it is outside of China, that it's safe and that they can maintain the history and the culture and the language. But more and more, we're seeing that China is still trying to reach outside their borders in order to have that control. So that way they can try for that complete erasure.
Because this is what erasure looks like now. It doesn't always come with police raids or prison camps. Sometimes it arrives in your inbox wrapped in good intentions, kind of whispering, don't trust the things that connect you to your culture.
What I'm hoping is that we won't see that fear and that we won't see people give into it and that we'll see almost a pushback and maybe even an increase in creation of tools.
Rebecca wants Uyghurs to keep building, to keep sharing, to keep fighting for their language and their history, digitally and otherwise. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina hosts the Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News. That story was produced by Sean Powers. Next up in the series, one tech innovator tried to keep Uyghur culture alive with an online space for sharing music and stories. What happened to him and his project? Catch that story next week here on The World. For Parisians who've always wanted to rub shoulders with some of the great cultural figures in world history, there is now an unconventional way to make that happen.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end.
Yes, unfortunately, it has to be at the end. But if you're into prime cemetery real estate, some prestigious plots have opened up. The city of Paris has launched a lottery to restore monuments within the overcrowded cemeteries of Père Lachaise, Montparnasse, and Montmartre. In return for sprucing up a gravestone or bringing a monument back to life, you can be buried nearby, meaning it is now possible to spend your eternal rest near famous artists, including Jim Morrison of The Doors, author Oscar Wilde, and legendary French singer Edith Piaf.
Or how about author Marcel Proust, whose remembrance of things past would certainly prove relevant for cemetery dwellers, or existentialist celebrities like Jean-Paul Sartre, Samuel Beckett, or Simone de Beauvoir.
Here's the backstory. Gravestones and monuments in Parisian cemeteries are maintained by families, not by the city. So over time, graves often become abandoned and decrepit. But just removing derelict monuments can be rough because the cemeteries are classified as protected heritage sites.
So they are looking for new caregivers. There is a catch. You must be Parisian to enter the lottery. City officials suggest they'll see what local interest is like and could open the lottery to outsiders sometime before the drawing in January.
Next, we're still in Europe. Leaders from the EU are paying diplomatic visits to Turkey. We'll explain why just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Let's head now to Turkey, where two European leaders have traveled recently. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the UK, went to Istanbul last week. Chancellor Friedrich Merz of Germany followed suit. Turkey's backslide on democracy has kept Europe at arm's length for more than a decade, but a growing threat from Russia and Turkey's potential role in defending Europe may be changing that, even as President Erdogan's crackdown on the opposition there reaches a whole new level. DW's Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish presidential band greeted Friedrich Merz as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan rolled out the red carpet for the German Chancellor. It was a busy week for the band. A few days earlier, it serenaded the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. Starmer's visit was to sign off on a multi-billion euro sale of Eurofighters produced by a four-country consortium, including Germany. The sale has been long coveted by Ankara as it desperately seeks to replace its decades-old jets. It was only possible thanks to Chancellor Merz, who lifted Berlin's veto on the sale. A veto which had been cast in part because of Turkey's deteriorating human rights record. Soli Özel of the International Relations Department at Istanbul's Kadarhas University claims the Eurofighter sale underscores a shift in European priorities amid the growing Russian threat.
Whether many people like it or not is going to have to be part of European security. Given Russia's proclivities and stuff. And by the way, since the European Union is no longer the European Union of our grandmothers, and so the issues of human rights, rule of law and all that no longer count for anything, that's a relation that is cleared of its thorns, if you will.
In a break from past protocols, neither Merz nor Starmer met with opposition leaders during their Ankara visit. The British Prime Minister's visit came just a day after espionage charges linked to British intelligence were filed against Istanbul's jailed opposition mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. Yet Starmer did not once comment on the case. Instead, both the German and British leaders' Ankara talks focused mainly on security cooperation. Federico Donelli of Trieste University says that with Turkey home to NATO's second largest army and a rapidly growing defence sector, there is potential for collaboration as Europe rearms to counter the Russian menace.
Many of the European defence systems are in some way compatible with the Turkish military hardware. At the same time, Turkey is one of the emerging players in the security market.
An advert by Turkey's Baykar company extolling the virtues of its military drones, claiming their successful use in conflicts extending from Ukraine to the Caucasus to Africa. It's niche fields of expertise, like drones, that Turkey's rapidly growing arms sector is focusing on, and they are key to Europe's rearmament. Political analyst Sezin Öner of Turkey's Political News Portal says Ankara is now seeking to join the EU's 150 billion euro arms procurement program called SAFE.
Being in SAFE will be a big win for Erdogan because any kind of removal of remaining sanctions or limitations or prejudices against Turkey strengthening in the defense sector and, of course, modernizing its air fleet, he can project it as a win for the domestic audiences.
However, EU members, Greece and the Greek Cypriot government are threatening to veto Turkey's participation in SAFE, citing ongoing territorial disputes, in particular over the divided island of Cyprus. Erdogan is waging a diplomatic campaign to secure international recognition of the Turkish Cypriot administration, which is currently recognized only by Ankara, and is ending any hope of the island's reunification. But this month's shock landslide victory of the Turkish Cypriot opposition might change that. The opposition won on a platform of resuming reunification talks. Former Turkish ambassador Selim Kunalp believes this may provide an opportunity for Erdogan to adjust his stance on Cyprus, thus persuading the Greeks to drop their opposition to Turkish participation in the SAFE arms procurement program.
Now that you've got these election results, you've got a new administration in northern Cyprus, a president who says that he wants to come back, you know, to the negotiations. Well, that opens a small window out of which Mr. Erdogan's administration might climb down.
But it's not going to be easy. Greek Cypriots' unease is likely to rise in correlation with the waxing strength of Turkey's military. Meanwhile, domestically, Erdogan's crackdown on opposition, civil society, and the media continues. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Before we leave you, exciting news for British soccer fans. He was captain of the English national team, won 6 Premier League championships. He even got a movie named after him in the early 2000s. And now David Beckham has a new claim to fame.
It was first suggested way back in 2002 after an especially monumental goal.
I don't believe it. David Beckham scores the goal to take England all the way to the World Cup finals. Give that man a knighthood.
The commentator there recommending Beckham for knighthood. Well,
Sir David Beckham, for services to sport and to charity.
It happened. David Beckham was knighted today by King Charles at Windsor Castle.
He knelt before the monarch, who did the ritual tap on Beckham's shoulders with a sword to make it official. Afterwards, Sir David told the press that when he heard about the honor, he cried.
I've been lucky to have won things in my career and done things and played for my country and captained my country. But without doubt, this is the moment that makes me very proud.
Proud because a knighthood acknowledges his achievement off the field in his charitable work. He did joke that he won't be making anyone call him Sir David at home.
If they would like to call me Sir Dad or Sir Son, they can. But no, it's going to take some getting used to, people saying it.
Beckham is the 14th soccer player to be knighted by the monarchy.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.